Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton. This episode is dedicated to the theme of atmosphere, what an artist can do with an environment in the physical sense of actual design, but also in the more ethereal sense of a headspace or a mental or emotional landscape, how someone can change the temperature of a room. And with me to talk about atmosphere today are the co-creators of the Poetry Brothel. They are Stephanie Berger. Thanks for coming on, Stephanie.
Hi.
And Nicholas Adamski. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Charlie. It's great to be here.
So I was told that you can get some pretty good sound quality from inside of a car with the windows rolled up. And here the three of us are driving on, what is this, US 5?
I-5.
We're on I-5 in California in the great...
California's Great Central Valley.
California's Great Central Valley.
America's breadbasket.
Yes.
I mean salad bowl. I mean produce department.
Is that a lemon orchard?
This is a lemon orchard to our... No, I think that's... These are...
Those are oranges.
Those are oranges and these are maybe grapes? Olives?
We're driving through several orchards. We have left Los Angeles where we've just performed a poetry brothel and we're about to perform... another poetry brothel in San Francisco.
That was a motorcycle. That was us.
Full disclosure, I have the distinct honor of being the master of ceremonies at the poetry brothel, and that's how I know these two. And I'm so excited to hear their thoughts on the development of this interesting creation, as well as how they use atmosphere to entice and affect their patrons. So, would you please explain to the listeners, what is a poetry brothel?
A poetry brothel is basically like any other brothel you might go to, but...
That sounds very risque and provocative.
Well, there's no sex, so it's like a brothel, but the prostitutes, instead of taking you in back rooms and having sex with you for money, they take you in back rooms and they read you poetry privately. It's one-on-one
for money.
Yeah, you have to pay them.
It's like a literary cabaret out front. We have a front of house stage show.
Do you have accordion?
With occasional annoying accordion music.
Yes.
Hey.
Yes.
It's a live cabaret show with jazz, with accordion, with
burlesque,
sometimes fire,
sometimes aerial performances.
Aerial. All number of variety acts, and then public readings by our...
Poetry whores.
It's true.
Poetry whores.
The idea of a brothel as a sort of frame story, as a trope for what it is that we do, is really important to us for a number of reasons. Brothels throughout history have been places where fringe elements of society were allowed to go and hang out and feel comfortable, and not even necessarily as like brothel patrons. Jazz was created in brothels in New Orleans around the turn of the century. Some of our favorite art was painted by painters associated with brothels in certain periods in Europe. We've always been...
Tango was popularized in Argentina in brothels. It was like seen as this sort of like vulgar, dirty dance. I mean, it's like
ragtime.
Yeah, I mean, there's all of this like music and painting and dance and
culture
that if at the beginning seems too risque for polite society to associate itself with, and so these artists have the opportunity to like perform or create or, you know, hang out in a brothel, you know, largely because in a brothel, these like social mores and politeness don't really have a place, for better or for worse in some cases.
What is the feminist context for the term poetry whore? How do you take this element of brothel, whore, madam, and make it positive?
I mean, so the concept of poetry whore, it's basically just like reclaiming that language and turning it into something that you want it to be. Basically, like any female who's like at all sexually expressive if you, you know, dress in a certain way, or if, you know, you like to have a lot of sex with people,
right.
You will probably be, like, called a whore, most likely to your face and very certainly behind your back. And so it's just kind of, it's a way of, like, turning that into something that's really positive. Like, literally when I use the word poetry whore now, it's like, I mean, you have to apply to be a poetry whore. You have to be, like, really, really awesome at all of these different things in order to have that honor. And
so it's funny, too, because the flip side of it is we also have poetry man whores.
We do have man whores, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's taking the language and turning it into what you want it to be, instead of having it be this, like, derogatory term that's thrown at you.
So this is an innovation in the realm of poetry, as far as what a reading of poetry might be. And I like the idea of atmosphere, because Nicholas and Stephanie have changed the atmosphere of what a typical poetry night, poetry reading venue could be, from the ground up.
Yes, that was our intention.
Yes. Yeah, basically, I mean, the idea initially sprung because we love poetry. We're poets. We met studying poetry together at the New School, and we would go to these poetry readings, and we love poetry, and we were bored, and we figured...
Deeply unsatisfied.
I mean, basically, it was like, poetry is so wonderful and so beautiful to us, and why are these people presenting it in a way that doesn't match the beauty of the work?
Yeah.
How on earth is anybody who doesn't already like poetry going to begin to appreciate it?
Right.
And
in this particular atmosphere.
Exactly. Right. I mean,
I think, fold up chairs,
halogen lights. I mean, you know, like, we would go to these readings in classrooms, and it's so uncomfortable. You're not allowed to talk during them. If you want to get up and go to the bathroom or something, you have to wait for the right moment. It's like, it's highly unnatural.
It's also an anxiety-ridden environment.
Yeah.
People are already, you know, putting themselves out there emotionally, creatively, intellectually, and then you fill it with a room of essentially, like, nervous people.
Yeah. And that's part of why, like, the characters come in handy as well, because if you put on this person that you want to be while you're presenting your poetry, and it's not as scary.
So, Stephanie, you said characters before, and at the Poetry Brothel, you have curated a list of characters, a lineup of all the poets, so that, and we all have pseudonyms of sorts. So Stephanie is the Madam, Nicholas is Tennessee Pink, and I, Charlie Layton, am Mr. Charlie, MC. And then there's a whole cavalcade of different characters of poetry whores.
Cavalcade?
Cavalcade.
There's a cavalry?
A Kelvincade?
And there's a whole wily, motley crew lineup of poetry whores with different personas. And I think that's atmosphere in the performative sense, where you have revolutionized what poetry performance can be. And there's a nice, fun dress-up element to it.
I don't think it's nice.
There's a naughty.
Yeah, edgy.
There's a naughty element to it. And yes, and our poets dress up in fancy bustiers or fishnets. The men sometimes do that too.
It's not about being naughty. It's just about embodying your character and empowering the poet to feel not only confident and comfortable, but also to give them a sort of different position in the room than an audience member.
Right.
So when people come in, despite the fact that some of our audience members do dress up and do take on the role of, take on a different character other than their own everyday persona, when you come into one of our shows, and this may be another way in which the Poetry Brothel is different from more conventional poetry readings, you know immediately who the performers are by the way that they're dressed, by the way that they're acting.
And the
the boudoir element is sort of almost a provocation or a risque sort of dare.
I mean, it's about, it's like totally just about intimacy, basically. The concept of the brothel is like, we just wanted to put a poet one-on-one with their audience member. It's sometimes really difficult to listen to a poem and to understand it. I mean, we've heard that like 1,000 times. I don't get poetry. But it's easier if the person who wrote it is sitting next to you and is saying it to you instead of, you know, far away from you. So the boudoir element is really just like putting two people together in a bed where you're comfortable.
So you are selling, you are offering artistic intimacy.
Yeah.
So what do you look for in a venue if we're talking about actual design, interior design? What do you look for in a venue to host an evening of poetry?
Well, the most important thing is that there's a separate area for the private readings, because we can really use any kind of space as long as there's an element of soundproofing to the back area.
Soundproofing, you say? I say that because we once... I say soundproofing because we have 2 years in a row made a poetry brothel at an EDM dubstep festival in what is a very, very loud performance space. And yet we've still managed to create that close quarter intimacy amidst all the bass nectar.
I guess the answer is that we can basically do it anywhere. What we're looking for when we're traveling and like taking our show on the road is something that looks sort of somewhere in the vein of like turn of the century, Belle Epoque, like New Orleans, Paris, Weimar, you know, kind of any venue that is within that theme will work, so that we're taking our audience into something that feels to them like kind of another world. We like to ideally do the poetry brothel in places that are kind of unexpected in terms of like, would you find poetry or art there? You know, we'll do it in like bars or clubs that poets wouldn't normally go to.
Right, and this is, I think it's innovative because you are making poetry accessible by the use of the venues, by the use of the costuming and the performative elements. You're making it even more accessible to the broader audience.
Yes.
Over the course of the almost 9 years that we've been doing this, we've done poetry brothels in a number of different kind of spaces, and what we've found is that there are a few elements that are vitally important. We need to have a space large enough to house, you know, 100 to 200 audience members comfortably in a way where they can see the performances happening. But then, like Stephanie said, we also need to have this back area that feels separate and intimate that we have some control over to make it, I like to say we like to set ourselves up for success. So like when Stephanie said we used to go to these poetry readings when we were in grad school, where there were white wall art galleries with overhead lighting and, you know, maybe like a table on the side where they were pouring, you know, cheap wine into plastic cups or something. We thought maybe we could do better than that aesthetically and bring something, bring people to a place that was, like Stephanie said earlier as well, as beautiful as the poetry that was being presented. It's not that we were going to poetry readings where people were reading bad poetry. It was just that the venue sort of couldn't get out of the way of the poetry. We don't want to have an atmospheric experience that is overwhelming the work that's happening. We just want something that complements it.
Exactly. And I think what you do provides a context for the listener to really take it in a way that if the atmosphere around the reading is a little bit too stark, a little bit too sterile, it's hard to tune in unless you're an aficionado, because you're used to just really zoning in and zeroing in on the words and the poetry. But I think that the improvements you make to the environment, the atmosphere, really help poetry be received more fully.
Yes.
Yes.
Definitely. Another thing that's really important to us is that the audience feels free to move about the cabin, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to a concert, nobody feels like they can't go to the bar whenever they want, or go to the bathroom whenever they want, or maybe even have a conversation. We don't encourage people to talk during our poetry readings at the show, but we also don't have poetry readings that go on for more than maybe, you know, 5 to 10 minutes at most.
It's like a variety show.
And we actually challenge our poets to be captivating enough to where people won't want to talk over them. I mean, we do it in environments where we do it in, you know, oftentimes just like in bars where the point of people going to that venue typically is to socialize and like talk to each other and drink and hang out. And so, you know, they're going to do that unless the poet really delivers something.
Right. And what I appreciate about the poets that you've found and their performative abilities is that it doesn't always rely on yelling poetry or slam, and that they find interesting and in creative ways to read the poetry, perform their poetry, and still be very, very captivating, very draw you in.
Nuanced,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's literature, you know, it's not, not every work of literature is meant to be yelled. In fact, most of them aren't.
Yeah, people don't, in our experience, generally respond favorably to yelling, and especially not yelling in like, long format. Also, poetry and our speech patterns are closer to each other than prose and our speech patterns, for example. So when reading a poem, unless the poem was only trying to deliver one emotional payload, you couldn't yell through a whole poem. Like, when we're having conversations, we modulate our voice. Like, when you're reading poetry, it should follow your conversational, in my opinion, speech patterns. So it changes. And if a poet gets on stage and just shouts at you, or if a poet gets on stage and just reads in a sort of monotone, they don't deliver the emotion that is usually inherently built into the poem. So we actually have a very difficult task when finding performers for the poetry brothel, because poets generally are not, what's the word I'm looking for? Extroverted?
Public speakers.
Good at public speaking, willing to go into a back room and be good one-on-one, to be performative, to be able to costume yourself.
A poetry whore is a very specific type of breed, because they have to be both extroverted enough to like perform well, enough of a performer to perform well on a stage, but also enough of like a real person to be able to sit intimately with someone and have a conversation and have a connection with someone, not just perform at them.
Right.
You know.
And I think this highlights a very interesting question about, is poetry meant to be read or is it meant to be heard? And can you connect with audience members in a group setting or one-on-one in your performance?
The idea of the poetry brothel, like, initially sprung from page poetry, like, specifically. Nick and I both have backgrounds in a more, like, academic form of poetry. We're not spoken word poets by background. Like, we write poems, we care about line breaks. And so the poetry brothel, part of the initial like concept of it was to make that type of poetry, which is normally whispered or like said in like poet voice, come alive. And part of the way that you can do that is through like intimacy. I mean, one of the nice things about the private readings, and like I'll have this happen all the time when I give private readings, is the person will follow along on the page with me. Like, they'll also be reading it. So I don't know. I mean, I really think that it's both. I think it's a visual art as well as an oral art.
And when you burn incense, it's olfactory.
It is.
That's very true. Also, while poetry began in the oral tradition, and then evolved to be something that was written down. I feel like poetry had a very long stretch as an oral art form, and then it had a very long stretch as a written art form, and the oral part of it dropped off for a while and changed and or became kind of homogenized.
Okay.
So for us, bringing back that orality, bringing back the oral tradition, you know, teaching people, reteaching people that poetry, when read to you by the person who wrote it, would really change the experience of the art form and also hopefully its position in culture and society.
So you've been making poetry brothels all over the country, even out of the country, for 9 years now?
It will be 9 years in December, or in January.
Yes.
How did you get started? What was the first poetry brothel like?
So I was volunteering at this place called the Living Theater in the Lower East Side, helping them organize an open mic. And when I initially thought of the concept, I was like, oh, well, I already have a relationship with this theater. I asked them if I could do it. They said yes. And so our initial show was supposed to be at the Living Theater, but about 2 days before the show, this article came out in the Village Voice. God, the poetry brothel used to be so cheap. This article came out in the Village Voice saying, you know, we might have paid more attention in high school English class if poetry came with your very own poetry horror and a shot of whiskey. It was $5 to get in. You got a free reading and a free shot of whiskey upon entry.
Wow.
Well, it turned out that the Living Theater didn't have a liquor license, and they saw this, and they got really nervous about it.
But they were going to be raided by
that
the
NYPD
during our poetry reading?
Well, I guess the Living Theater was, like, very radical in its heyday, and I guess they thought that people were, like, still paying attention like that, even though they, were, like, really weren't.
Well, we don't know that for a fact.
I mean, maybe they
Maybe there is a police captain out there, you know, out to get the Living Theater.
It's possible, yeah. Anyways, so they canceled our show 2 days before it, and I, like, ran around the East Village just, like, asking bars, can I have this, like, weird show in your place? Finally, this place called the Mug Lounge said yes, which was, like, essentially a tiny, tiny, like, house music club. They were like, yeah, that sounds cool. We like poetry. Why not? So we staged a protest. This was January 18th, 2008. We staged, like, a protest outside of the Living Theater. We made these signs that said, like, New York is dead. Poetry is banned in New York. In order to, like, kind of grab our patrons that were coming to the poetry brothel there, and, like, led them in this little procession through the snow up to the Mug Lounge, where there was, like, house music playing, and we held, like, a little impromptu poetry brothel there. It was so much fun. It was amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I love how you do put an emphasis on fun
in
all of your events.
It's true, yeah. Well, you know,
we have a masquerade, we have a theme, we have so much frivolity amongst the import.
Yeah, I mean, most poetry readings are so boring. I can't even emphasize that enough. Most poetry readings are terribly boring. And like I said, I love poetry. It's, like, the most important thing to me, and I can't sit through most of them. It's horrible. And so the poetry brothel, like,
such low energy, monotone delivery.
Exactly.
One microphone. Muted clapping.
It's just so awful to sit through them for the most part.
No atmosphere.
Yeah, no atmosphere.
No atmosphere. Or a bad atmosphere. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyways, so yeah, one of the initial, like, tenets of the poetry brothel was just, like, never be boring. So
The original motto of the poetry brothel.
Actually, yeah, that was the tagline.
Our mission statement was to never be boring. It's interesting to me, if that Living Theater brothel had not gotten canceled or changed, we would have done our first show in a professional historical black box theater and we had sort of built a stage show concept around the specific space of the Living Theater, and were prepared to do that show, and then we sort of at the last minute had to augment it to work basically on the dance floor of a bar.
Right.
Yeah.
And we went from there to a small art gallery, and then we went from there to sort of a different, like, grungier art gallery, but there was just...
So is that how you realized this is a movable feast?
Well, we definitely knew that pretty early on, though we do like to have a home base, but I just think it's very interesting to me to think about how the evolution of the show might have been different had we done it in a theater for the first year or two,
having,
you know.
Like sound and lighting and like a stage.
Yeah, and yeah.
It might have been too much theater then.
And that's the thing. It might have gone really theatrical right off the bat and come out a completely different thing. Like,
the intimacy or the...
I'm not sure exactly. Well, that was the other part about the Living Theater, is that there wasn't really anywhere
to do private readings. Yeah.
And so when we did the second Poetry Brothel, which was on Valentine's Day of that same year, so just about 1 month after the original iteration, we did it at a place called the Jonathan Shore Gallery in Soho, which was a very, like, strange get for us as a venue. But it was a two-floor art gallery, so there was a little gallery on the bottom, on the first floor, where we did our public readings and had our little bar set up. And then there was actually, like, a couple little anterooms off of that that we brought in, like, pillows and fabric. And, you know, like, sort of from the beginning, pillows, fabric, candlelight, and red light bulbs have been staples of the Poetry Brothel decor.
Yeah.
And
that's our kit.
And it's pretty funny how, or maybe amazing would be a better word, how, you know, thrift store trinkets that, you know, cost less than $5 can become magical in candlelight, or how a really ugly piece of fabric that maybe has like a nice texture can become really magical under the light of a red light bulb. In the corner of a room, you know, we went into these places that were not beautiful places, and with just lighting and a little bit of fabric, I like to say, like, you know, a staple gun and some, like, hopes and dreams, we can turn
and
a lot of praying, we can turn, you know, almost any space that we've gone into from, you know, kind of a mundane, common, expected place into something that feels really magical and intimate. I also like to say that we're kind of like adult fort builders, because everywhere we go, we're essentially building blanket forts that people can crawl into. And, you know, I mean, it's almost like being at a sleepover and, like, having someone, like, pull you into a blanket fort and, like, you know, tell you secrets. It has that level of, like, wonder and intimacy and innocence as well. I mean, we really, you know, we are taking these sort of unsuspecting audience members into, like, a secret place and telling them our secrets. Like, we're bearing our souls to them, but there's something so really pure and beautiful that happens when, you know, a person who's never had an experience like this before gives a poker chip, which they spent $5 or $10 on, to an artist, and then that artist shares their, like, life's work with that person, and they get to literally share it, like, one to one, and there's an exchange that feels like a material way of appreciating something, which is just very rare for poets. So that was a really driving force in the creation of this project.
It's almost as if the world has to change for the poetry to be truly appreciated. You can't just throw it out into this cold world when it's such a delicate thing. You have to transform the world around it so that it can truly live and breathe. And I appreciate
it's certainly helps. It's just like anything, you know, like if we spent all day shopping at farmers markets and preparing a really beautiful meal, we wouldn't like dump it out on the table and invite you to like come eat it, you know, like we would want to like set the table and we would want to like change the lighting in the room and like we might put on like a kind of like soft music or something, you know. It's, we really want to like build the environment around the art form so that the experience of the art form can be as rich and full as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. Hey, if you're interested in supporting this podcast for free, then please leave a positive rating and review on iTunes. And if you're not interested in supporting the show for free, then why not make a generous donation to my GoFundMe.com campaign? All of the necessary links are provided in the description of this episode. And if you act now, I'll send you some free Neo Bohemia stickers. Thanks, and now back to our program.
Welcome back to Neo Bohemia. We're talking to Stephanie Berger and Nicholas Adamski, the creators of the Poetry Brothel, about atmosphere. So you met in grad school and you started creating brothels in 2008. What were they like at the beginning?
I guess at the beginning it was more of like an art party. You know, it was more of a party and less of a... We didn't have a stage at any of our initial shows. There wasn't like a show that you sat and watched in addition to the private readings. There were sort of these like bursts of a performance that happened like within the space. But we didn't necessarily like always have an MC like you, Mr. Charlie.
Oh.
It was...
And who was your audience?
Our initial audience was, you know, people like us. We were in graduate school when we started, so it was a lot of grad students, maybe some undergrads, you know, the New York art student community.
It was our community.
Yeah.
The other thing about the early brothels, too, is we had this kind of our, I was always thinking about Oscar Wilde in those days and how, like, there are stories of Oscar Wilde sort of sitting in the back of the bar and all night long, bar patrons would come up to him and can like ask him to tell them a story or read a poem or do some kind of performance, and he would always say no, and then of course at the end of the night or at some point stand up and what's the word I'm looking for?
Patronize?
No, it's not that exactly, but you know what I mean, like
satisfy
that, you know, like give them what they wanted.
Yes.
So there was this idea in the original, or the early iterations of the Poetry Brothel, that there would be these spontaneous bursts of poetry where, you know, poets would just stand up on a table or a chair or something anywhere in the room, and, you know, we'd point a flashlight at them, literally, and maybe hand them a microphone, and they would just sort of, you know, have this Quaker-like need to speak and fill the room with their poetry. So we were just, you know, we were experimenting with all different sort of formats and ideas of, like, how can we really just change and subvert and evolve and grow the concept of people hearing poetry read in a space during an event.
And so over the course of those early years, the show grew and expanded and evolved into what it is now, which is more of like a cabaret, big show, along with the initial core private reading.
Yeah, in the early days, we never had burlesque. Like, I think it was suggested to us at some point early on.
Often.
You know, why don't you have burlesque at this? This seems like a burlesque show. And we thought it would kind of like distract or take away from the poetry of it.
Poetry of the flesh.
The poetry of the flesh. Yeah, well, I mean, it turned out that burlesque was actually really good for sort of changing the energy in the room. Like, you know, if a poem gets read, there's like this sort of moment of quiet And then if you have a burlesque performance immediately after that, the energy of the room lifts up and gets a little more dynamic. And then you can move from there into music and, you know, just sort of, I mean, it really is, the burlesque adds a lot to the atmosphere and just like shifting the energies around.
It really is. It's like what one thing that we have become experts at, or certainly significantly better at than we were in the beginning, is controlling the pace and the energy and the atmosphere, exactly like what Stephanie just said. We didn't get all of the dynamics of the kind of event that we were trying to throw in the early days. We didn't know, you know, like we worked so hard to teach our audience how to be quiet during the poetry reading, and we worked so hard to teach our poets how to be so good that they captivated the audience into that kind of quiet, like contemplative almost moment. And then we were like, how the hell do we get them out of this back into a party? Because we always wanted to have a really like fun, upbeat party atmosphere. Even if someone were to read like a really devastating poem, you know, it's almost like that kind of like jazz funeral motif where it's like we commiserate, we share in each other's pain and suffering, and then we celebrate.
Right.
So that's kind of where, you know, burlesque came through. And then also, you know, in the beginning,
traditional jazz.
Yeah, and in the beginning, we, you know, we had whole periods of time where we'd plug in an iPod and play a playlist. A lot of times because that's what we could afford in those days. But sometimes we were like, well, you know, it's not a concert, you know, and it's not a burlesque show that poetry is read at. We were really fervent about making sure that poetry always remained at the center of the event.
Yeah.
And what we've realized over time is that the more components we add and the more elements that we do and the more theatrical that we make it, just the more that the poetry gets highlighted and the more the audience wants to go into the back room and have a poetry, you know, a poem read to them. And, you know, the more that the audience is just like totally ready at the drop of a dime or, you know, the ringing of a bell actually to quiet down and consume this art form that these people are trying to communicate to them.
And also you're able to bring in special guest poets who read at the top of the show, and that draws in, you know, devotees, people in the community.
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it is quite a ride.
Yeah, well, and it's also interesting that, like, for a very long time, we were really racking our brains trying to figure out how we could make this a, how we could get all of our poetry friends and all of the people in the poetry community to come to this event to see, you know, basically our idea of what poetry could be or what how poetry could be presented. And what we've learned is that this is really a poetry event for non-poets and non-poetry people. It's really like an entry point to this art form to people who are not accustomed to interacting with it or experiencing it.
Yeah, the poets are already converted, so they don't need it in the same way. They're like, I like this stuff already. So.
And it's so dynamic, too, because you have big show, stage readings, public readings, and then you have intimate setting, private reading, and so you get a nice variety of performance. So I met Nicholas and Stephanie for the first time over 4 years ago when the Poetry Brothel was being performed at the Back Room. My wife is one of the regular poetry whores.
Well, I wouldn't call her regular. I think she's quite extraordinary, actually.
I met you because of Rachel, who plays Cosette Chapiteau in the Poetry Brothel, was dating you.
Yes.
And brought you to the New York City Poetry Festival, which Nick and I also produce. And I can't remember if you had your accordion or if she had told me that you played the accordion. And I met you, and you were so handsome, and we were looking for an MC at that point. We were, like, actively, you know, trying to find someone who would actually host the show so we didn't have to do it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, he would be perfect. I mean, you look like, you just look like a vaudevillian.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And another big thing about the atmosphere in those early days was Stephanie and I have such an evolved comedic sense of timing and delivery that we would just get on stage and to the common observer, it would seem like we were really unprepared and didn't really know what we were talking about and didn't care that much, when obviously none of those things are true. We just thought it was funny to like make everything seem like it wasn't that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Which we discovered later is absolutely the wrong way to go about hosting a show.
And for a brief moment, Stephanie the Madam adopted a surly Russian persona.
I did.
It was not a moment either. It was the first 4 years.
It was the first 4 years.
Those are the years when I would literally have to completely re-give an interview to a reporter after the madam had given one, because it would A, communicate no information, B, be largely like indecipherable. But we were committed to that sort of theatricality, or Stephanie certainly was very early on.
True.
But I walked into a context of an event of a show that had a clear, already, it was already established, a clear sense of cabaret vaudeville, which really appealed to me. And to be an MC for a show like this, it's grueling in that it's a lot of acts. All the poets read, the dancers have acts, and then the bands have their regular sets. And so it is just boom, 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 all these different showstopper performances. And so it's a lot of time management. And then it's also, I get to jump into this fantastically unique context of a show where I get to, you know, pal around with the audience and then introduce all these amazingly talented poets. And I was blown away that there was something like this to host.
Oh.
Well, we didn't. There wasn't anything like this to host before we created the Poetry Brothel, and there kind of wasn't anything like this to host for the first few iterations of the show until we sort of got it to where it was.
So it evolved.
And we also, I mean, it's hard to know how or why exactly this happened, but we created and started performing the Poetry Brothel like at the perfect exact moment, if not maybe even a few months before, of this new kind of theater in New York City specifically, and then it's now going around the world, of the truly immersive, you know, audience participation, or at least audience inclusion, into the context of the show. And so, while we had, obviously, from, you know, day one, the idea of, you know, taking people out of the audience into a second location and giving them a unique experience.
Site-specific.
We grew up around all of these other shows, like Sleep No More, Lady of the Night, you know, what have you.
Speakeasy Dollhouse,
for example, where other directors and producers were trying to create that experience, and it was a thing that was evolving like in super real time in an accelerated way, because it was happening all around, you know, it was happening around us in the city where we lived.
And one of
I feel like Prohibition era everything like came into vogue like almost at the exact moment that we started the Poetry Brothel. I guess 2008 was like the recession. Was like the whole.
It was the big. It was the great recession.
And speaking of speakeasies, the Poetry Brothel, when I came into it, was being performed at a historic speakeasy, the back room.
We kind of had to like earn the back room.
We definitely had to earn. There are a lot of venues that are hesitant, if not just immediately, like door close in your face, kind of in response to anything that has the word poetry. But what we really had to do, and what we find that we have to do in almost every city that we go to, is take whatever we can get in terms of venue. We get the best thing that we can get, but venue owners are hesitant to book a poetry show. So it's something where we have to go into a city, and we absolutely had to do this in New York. We had to get a venue and make the absolute best of it, and then work really hard to get a lot of great press and show that we could build our own audience and show that we could draw a crowd. When we first approached the back room, it was a hard no. And then, you know, literally 2 years later, we approached them again, which I don't even know why we did that, but maybe we just thought that, you know, with the audiences that we were getting at the venue that we had,
we just knew that we were in like a, we were in a different place, a different bargaining position.
Exactly.
Yeah, and
but we went into the back room with stipulations. Like, we weren't allowed to use the back room. Is unique in that it has a secret back room that you get to through a bookcase.
So it's perfect.
So it's perfect for this literary cabaret. With a speakeasy theme, you know? But so when we first were at the back room, they were like, well, yeah, you can do it here, but you can't use the back room. We don't want people to, we don't want just anybody to be able to go back there because they're like a member of the audience of your show.
Oh, but that's what I want.
So for a year of doing shows at the back room, we weren't allowed to use the back room.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So then we had to prove to them that we could like make them enough money and, you know, to make it worth it.
Yeah. And you've since moved to the House of Yes.
Yes.
In Brooklyn. And the experience of asking Anya and Kay, can we do this? Yes.
What about this? Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, we really want to light these people. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, the, getting to do it at the House of Yes has been like a real breath of fresh air. We've been connected with the House of Yes people since like day one of the Poetry Brothel. I think they also got started in like 2007 2008, and the space that we're in, the space that they're in now, is the third iteration of the House of Yes. And the first two places were just not right for the Poetry Brothel in any way, and even though we knew them and we liked them and, you know, we're part of sort of on the same community and friendly, it wasn't an actual space that we could use. And so when they moved into the venue that they're in now, it was so exciting to, you know, approach a venue owner who is also really like an artist and got it and, you know, was just said yes to everything that we wanted to do. It was amazing.
And the Poetry Brothel has been expanding.
Almost
immediately. And you've been expanding.
Almost immediately. Within a year of us creating the Poetry Brothel in New York, one of our original cast got in touch with us to see if we'd be okay with her starting a chapter in Barcelona. And in the first year, we were so focused on, when we had the first few Poetry Brothels, we didn't even know that it was going to be a thing that was going to go on.
When we did the first show, we didn't know there were going to be many shows.
Yeah, we thought we were just throwing this party.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think we had an inkling that it might be something we could do a couple of times.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, there is a model of, like, the poetry reading series that
right.
has existed for a number of years.
Sure.
But, I mean, you know, setting up a podium in a bar or having a microphone in an art gallery once a month or once a week or whatever is not the undertaking that we sort of half on purpose got ourselves into.
Yeah.
But as soon, you know, in the first year of getting the show going, we were so consumed with just figuring out what it was and how it would work that we weren't really thinking about, you know, attempting to do it in other cities. But one of the very original people in our very first cast, Kylie Sweat, moved to Barcelona just as we were starting the Poetry Brothel in New York, and as soon as she got her language skills in check and her sort of legs underneath her in that city, she reached out to us to see if we'd be okay with her doing an iteration of the Poetry Brothel there, which immediately lit up the light bulb in her head, like, oh my goodness, this is something that not only could be done in almost any city in the world, but ought to be done. Like,
yeah.
We felt like it was a big part of our mission to bring this experience to as many people as we possibly could.
Mm-hmm. And now, how many cities have the Poetry Brothel been performed in?
God.
New York?
New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, New Orleans, Chicago.
Philadelphia.
Boston.
Not yet.
Almost Boston. Boston on September 9th.
And all over the world?
And then, yeah, and then Barcelona, Madrid, Paris, London, Dublin, Bogota, Valparaiso, Caracas, Oaxaca, Tampa, Florida.
Antwerp.
Brussels.
So that's quite impressive.
I mean, yeah.
Edmonton.
It's growing.
Edmonton.
Kingston, New York.
Oh, yeah, there was that poetry brothel in Akron, Ohio.
Right.
Remember those?
Maybe Hong Kong, or wasn't
oh,
there?
Oh, yeah, there was one in Thailand.
Yeah. Also New Zealand. Auckland.
In New Zealand.
There have been a lot, maybe not a lot, but there have certainly been one-off iterations or different sort of performance groups will do one poetry brothel, maybe as a fundraiser or as like a just part of their schedule, or, you know, like a one-off thing. Producing a poetry brothel and staffing it and having the poets and getting the audience is not an easy thing to do. So the people around the world who are responsible for creating these shows are all like incredibly dedicated people who really, really want to see this kind of thing happening in their community. And it really takes a lot of sacrifice to make a poetry brothel happen. It is a labor of love.
Well, how does it feel to see your idea spread all over the world?
It's honestly amazing. I can't believe that it's so widespread.
Here we are.
But you can believe it because it's such a great concept. No.
I mean, it makes sense. It's just, you know, like what we were saying earlier, like a poetry whore is such a specific breed of human being. The fact that there are these people all over the world that it speaks to is really amazing. And, you know, when we go and meet these people in the various cities around the world, there's like immediately this understanding and connection and this intimacy between us.
I can't believe that I get to travel with you two on the third West Coast tour.
Yeah.
Of the Poetry Brothel, and that there's another one coming along the way in a couple months.
It's awesome. It's so cool.
So you guys are on fire.
Woo-hoo-hoo! We are on fire.
Ow!
It's pretty incredible. I mean, you know, if someone had told us, or if we had told someone 8 or 9 years ago that we were going to create a poetry reading series out of our, you know, grad school program at the New School, that, you know, would not only exist for 8 years or 9 years or on and on, but would also become a thing that would, like, spawn branches all over the world, and then also a thing that would actually produce enough revenue to send us and you on tours that are not, like, that we're not paying for out of our own pockets. It would have been, like, I would have been skeptical myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Or that a poet could join your brothel and actually get paid.
Yeah. I mean, we always knew that was going to happen because that was, like, the central driving force.
Yeah, that was one of the main things.
If that hadn't happened, we would have stopped doing it.
Yeah.
But inherent to, like, our understanding of the art that we create and we're creating then was that it was something of value and not just, you know, some kind of ethereal societal artistic value where everyone does better when there are poets in the community, but a thing where, you know, if you hire a band to play at your wedding, they're gonna demand to be paid.
Right.
If you go into an art gallery and take a painting off the wall, that painter is going to demand that you pay them. If someone was to ask a poet to write a poem for their wedding and perform it, the poet would probably just feel honored.
Yeah.
And you know, despite the fact that the poet, like, whether it was a poem that they spent, you know, like, their kind of whole life up until that point creating in their mind before writing it down, or if the poet sat down for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours over the course of a couple of days to write the poem for that wedding, for that couple that they loved, they would, like, literally in no case ever expect to be paid for that.
Right.
And it's not that we want poets to go around charging people to read poems at their weddings, necessarily, but just the ethos of poetry as a profession.
The belief that your work, it has value.
Yeah.
And in this capitalistic sense, that it has value that can be compensated.
Yeah, like an inherent monetary value for your labor.
It blows my mind that you can get people to come to an event and hand over money to a poet for
poetry.
For their poetry. And that they will do this and that they'll love it. And that they'll come back.
It's true. It's awesome.
It blows my mind, too.
So how can our listeners learn more about the Poetry Brothel?
You can go to our website, thepoetrybrothel.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
You can email us.
You can email us thepoetrybrothel@gmail.com. You can.
And I will provide all of these links in the description of this episode.
That's so professional of you.
Thank you, Charlie.
You're welcome. This was Stephanie Berger and Nicholas Adamski of the Poetry Brothel, and I'm Charlie Layton of Neo Bohemia. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
So won't you please say hello?